Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Kakadu plum is an Australian native superfood containing 100 times more vitamin C than oranges. So why have you never heard of it? PR. No one's drinking a Kakadu smoothie? I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward, inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Julie Douglas.
And, you know, Julie, the title of today's podcast is, Does My Dog Really Love Me? Or something to that effect. It's like, you know, it's
yeah.
Yeah. We just nailed it down, but I've already forgotten it. But the original title that I had pitched was Your Dog Doesn't Love You, and we decided not to go with that because, it's a little anti-dog, and I didn't want to come off as this dog-hating cat person.
Well, and the jury's a little bit out on that, right?
Yeah.
We can't definitively say your dog doesn't love you.
Yeah.
Because there's some interesting data out there.
Though I just want to point out that if you're Josh Clark, you can apparently definitively say that dogs are man's best friend. And quote, even if you're strictly a bona fide cat lover, it's nearly impossible not to be moved by the brand of loyalty unique to dogs. That's from Josh's HowStuffWorks article, Our Dog Truly Man's Best Friend, which is worth reading, But Josh has a bit of a thing in for cats. I think he was licked by them as a child or something.
I think so, too. He was afraid they were going to steal his breath.
Yeah. But I admit, I tend to side more with the cat, on the cat side of the old dogs versus cats argument. And I'm not trying to stir up a big debate because I think there's a lot of crossover between the affinity we have for our animals and the often ridiculous ideas we get in our head about what they are and what our relationship with them consists of.
Oh, you're talking about anthropomorphizing, where we project all of our feelings onto cat, dog, sometimes a robot, you name it.
Yeah, but the interesting thing is there's been a lot of studies into exactly what's going on beyond the whole, this dog is my child, this dog is my friend.
Right.
You know, there have been some actual studies into what's going on in the brain when we interact with dogs. What's going on in the dog's brain when it's interacting with us?
Right.
And you know, there's no denying that these are amazing creatures, and the relationship they have with us is pretty bizarre and pretty incredible. You have a species that just lives throughout the world. Often in luxurious environment, well, sometimes in not so luxurious environments, but you have some dogs that are really living well and really benefiting from all the fruits of human culture without actually having to do any work.
Yeah, well, let me just spring this little stat on you. According to the NOVA documentary, Dogs Decoded, there are more pet dogs than babies in the world.
Wow.
Nearly half a billion. So, yeah, of course they've got their own clothes and furniture and, you know, they've got their own little dinner plates.
And according to The World Without Us author Alan Wiseman, if human civilization were to stop tomorrow, most of these dogs would just vanish because it's not like the second coming and the rapture and all that, but they would die out pretty steadily in most cases because they wouldn't be able to support themselves. They wouldn't be able to feed themselves in the environment.
Because they're that dependent on us.
Yeah, they're dependent on us. I mean, likewise with the cats. A lot of the cats would die and others would just become feral because we've created these artificial environments and we've propped up these species and allowed them to just run wild, you know, around the world. Even if running wild is only in your living room or your backyard.
Right. I mean, we can't help it because we look at these dogs, we look at puppies, and we instantly feel a connection, right? We already know that this is scientifically proven.
Yes, we've seen the release of oxytocin in the brain.
Yeah.
In two cases. One, when we're just interacting with our dog and we're making a long gaze eye interaction, which is like
we lock eyes.
Yeah. There's a 2009 Japanese study, and they took 55 dog owners. All right, they brought them in, and they had all the dog owners pee in a cup. And then they tested.
Sounds nice.
Yeah. Tested the urine for oxytocin levels. And then they put them in the playroom, let them play with their dogs. All right. And then they observed how they're interacting with their pets. Then the dog owners came back in and they took another urine sample, which I guess they had to have had a drink while they were in there playing with their dogs. I don't think I'd be able to go twice like that. And they also had a control group, where some owners sat in a room with their dog and were told to completely avoid looking at their animal.
Right.
So they found that there was a 20% increase in oxytocin levels in the people who made long gaze eye contact with their dog. That's where they're looking on average, 2.5 minutes of eye contact during play.
Okay.
And so people are benefiting from this relationship. They're feeling really good about it.
It's mutually beneficial to them. Mm-hmm. And then also we should talk a little bit about oxytocin. This is that feel-good hormone that is released.
Yes.
And a lot of people think about it more in the example of an infant and its mother during the breastfeeding process.
Right.
Because that's when oxytocin is released for both the mom and the baby, and they're both feeling all lovey-dovey and content. And oxytocin is great because it's an incredible stress reducer. And they have actually found that people who are dog owners are less likely to have heart attacks. And if they do have a heart attack and they are a dog owner, they're 3 to 4 times more likely to actually survive that heart attack. That's how powerful oxytocin is.
Hmm.
And a possible reason why we feel such a bond to our animals, in particular dogs.
Now, of course, it's worth noting that if you don't survive that heart attack, dogs or cats will probably eat your feet. But that just goes with the territory.
Yeah. At the very least, lick them.
Yeah. Well, it starts with licking, and then it becomes eating because they can't help themselves.
Is this the situation where they just then all go feral and...
Yeah. Yeah. And then they go feral in the living room.
Yeah. Yeah. They run around. So we know that the oxytocin and this sort of connection makes us want to cuddle and care for them. And again, in Nova's Dogs Decoded, there was a section in which they featured psychologist Morten Kringelbach, and he put adults in a Meg scanner, which is like a supercharged neuroimager.
Okay.
And then he showed them photos of adult faces, infant faces, and puppy faces. Nothing else, just like the big face looming in the background or with a dark background. And what he found is that within 1/7 of a second, their orbital frontal cortex, which is involved in emotional responses, started to light up. And it showed activation only when people looked at infants and puppies, not other adults. And he called this the parental instinct.
Yeah, or it's basically the cute factor. It's why people love like cute overload. It's why if you're like PETA or somebody, you're going to put a baby seal on the cover of your promotional material. Or a half-naked woman, but in many cases, or Greenpeace or various organizations, you'll see that like the white baby seal is the one to put on because its face looks so much like an infant. You look at cute cartoon characters and you can see like the big eyes and the small head and the various measurements that map up with a baby's face.
Yeah. And you've actually even mentioned this when we've talked about robots and having robots in the service industry, mm-hmm. that they're in Japan, that they've got the really super cute looking robots that actually to us look, you know, us here in the West look kind of creepy because it does look like cartoon character giant robots. but so, yeah, there's definitely something to that. So, I mean, there you go. That is the basis, a very good scientific basis for why we feel the way we do about dogs. So, okay, we've got the bond with them.
Right.
And we know from fossil records that we have a really long history with dogs.
Right. This didn't just start up in the last 100 years.
Yeah, yeah. No, this was like 100,000 years ago. We know that we started to hang out with them. But why would we hook up with canine familius anyway?
Well, the most immediate answer that comes to mind is that we were probably in a situation where we were either competing with the wolves for food, or the wolves were food, or both. and after you've killed a whole bunch of adult wolves, you might find all these little baby cuddly wolves. All right, and you go there, and your first instinct, well, you probably have two competing instincts. One is, hey, let's fry these puppies up because the tribe is hungry and these look delicious. But then on the other hand, they look kind of like human babies. So it's suddenly,
and your belly is full.
And your belly is full. And they're harmless. They're unlike the adult wolves who just strangled to death on the primeval plain, or beat to death with a stone.
Right.
These things aren't attacking you. They're maybe licking your hand and they look cute. So you're like, all right, well, let's take these back to the camp and play with them for a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so this sort of bond could have developed, and then all obviously wolves, we know, are the closest relative to dogs, right? So at some point, dogs separated from wolves. So it's very likely that we began to see the worth in having these little pups around that then became really good hunters along with us.
Right.
And if you look at dog domestication, which happened around 15,000 years ago, that's about the same time that we quit doing the whole nomadic hunter-gatherer thing and switched over to being agrarians.
Right.
So, you know, then we're much more localized, and it makes sense to have a dog around that can help you hunt, that's really fast and efficient with their own food consumption and how they use it as fuel, right? So they don't have to eat a whole lot themselves. And they can guard, right?
Right.
And that, in turn, makes us much more successful as a species.
Right. And you can, and it's also worth noting, there's a show on Discovery and BBC called Human Planet, and it's a great example of this whole hunting and then raising the young kind of situation with the Owa Guaja people of the eastern Amazon, and they hunt and kill monkeys, which they eat, and they, you know, make into a delicious looking stew of
monkey
stew.
Brains.
Yeah. Well, I don't know about eating brains, but they're definitely stewing up some monkeys. But then they'll bring the baby monkeys back to camp, and they'll not only raise them as pets, but in some cases they'll actually breastfeed the really young baby monkeys, which is, you know, even more than more oxytocin released into the system through that. But it's just such an interesting glimpse into how humans work. Just the idea that you could on one hand kill and eat this particular species, but then also raise it up as a pet. And then in this case, they don't actually eat the monkeys that they raise as pets. So there's a difference there. But then you have situations, I mean, clearly you have people who are really attached to baby goats that may grow up to become a food source. So you see plenty of examples in human culture where there's even this divide between the baby and the edible adult it will become.
Right. Yeah. And just to go back to oxytocin again, and I have read this before, that it's actually pretty addictive, apparently for new moms, and that it does give you a big rush. So it's sort of interesting that, you know, you see those instances of surrogate breastfeeding happening.
Oh, like a wet nurse could be an oxytocin addict, really.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it is an altruistic act, but you have to wonder, you know, if they're just doing it for the rush.
Ooh, so maybe this is completely unproven, but maybe the situation was we domesticated dogs and are working on monkeys because you have these oxytocin addicted nursemaids who are running wild through the woods saying, like, give me some puppies. Let me breastfeed some puppies, you know, because I got to get that rush.
Wow. I've seen like this Pulp Fiction movie, like set 15,000 years ago. I'm thinking about Daryl Hannah now as a crazed wet nurse. This is not good.
Yeah. And
we got to get back.
Yeah. That's totally unproven. Do not use that as an answer.
We got to get back. Yeah.
Students.
Yeah. But then another reason that we would hang out with canines and domesticate them is their sense of smell, which again would help with hunting. Mm-hmm. And in fact, canters apparently have a smell that dogs can be trained to detect, according to a growing body of research. And actually, they've had some small trials which have shown canines capable of detecting melanoma on a person's skin and lung and breast cancers by chemical cues in the person's breath. The trick, according to Auburn University veterinarian Larry Myers, is the ability of dogs to smell the multiple layers of chemicals. So mm-hmm. it's so much more nuanced and sophisticated in the rather than the way that we detect smells.
Right.
They've got a lot more parts to their system, so to speak. So all of this adds up to the fact that that dogs have definitely helped us to become successful in our survival. And certainly dogs themselves have become very successful in their survival.
Right. And it's interesting too to look at, okay, just on the surface of things, dogs definitely have emotion. Whether or not they can, there's this thing called love and they can feel it. That's a different issue, but definitely emotion has evolved as an adaptation in numerous species.
Mm-hmm.
It bonds animals to one another. It catalyzes and regulates a wide variety of social encounters among both friends and competitors, and it permits animals to protect themselves adaptively. And with dogs, the curious thing is that dogs are much more social than, say, cats.
Right.
Because, like my cat doesn't want any part of another cat. Except to chase them off. And they're just not social. For some reason, she may want to live with humans, but
right.
The heck with all other cats. Dogs, however, much more social. They have a much more social mind. And therefore, there's this, they have this whole alpha, situation where one alpha can dominate the others. And there's this dominant and passive thing in the way they behave. So we've been able to interject ourselves into this system.
Right.
Where we either become the dominant master of the dogs,
mm-hmm.
or we become this thing that the dog is possessive of, which is generally not the ideal situation, but you see it all the time.
Yeah, and that's interesting, again, to draw those parallels and see how we are more alike than different than dogs in the sense that we are really social creatures. And certainly 15,000 years ago, we were, you know, carnivorous, not all of us are now, but, mm-hmm. and we really relied on hunting.
Yeah.
So same thing with dogs, right?
Yeah. You had this dog's like growing up among people and there's this guy and he's like saying, "Hey, I'm the pack leader. Let's go catch ourselves some food." And the dog's like, "Yeah, I'm game for that. That's totally what I've evolved to do. So let's make it happen."
And by the way, there are like 30 of you guys, 5 of us.
Yeah.
You guys have the clubs. You can be the pack master, fine, you know? So part of it is like you kind of wonder how much the dogs are going along in their own survival.
Yeah. And then you get into all this, these other weird areas too, where like you take a dog's natural hunting instinct
mm-hmm.
and then you kind of pervert it over the ages to create, say, a herding animal where you're like saying, "Hey, you guys are really good at catching these animals, but let's work on you not killing them, but just moving them around, in exactly the place I want them to be."
Right.
Yeah.
When you're talking eugenics, right?
Right, yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, actually, eugenics became pretty popular in 19th century Europe, right? So there's this drive to perfect and design our environments, including pets.
Right.
And of course, you have this sort of newish technology, too, in eugenics. So they applied that to dogs through selective breeding. So you're like in the scenario you were talking about, that's like a border collie, right?
Right.
And so this allowed us to basically breed out traits and breed in traits, as you said. And you know, of course, now we have our little tiny, toy poodles and everything from that to like a mastiff, right? And you mm-hmm. can take everything in between and sort of mush it up and see what you can get. So it is amazing to think that right now, 80% of dog breeds are modern breeds that we created. So that's 400 genetically distinct dog breeds.
This presentation is brought to you by Intel, sponsors of tomorrow.
So in many of these cases, we are breeding, selectively breeding animals to encourage particular traits
yeah.
that allow them to perform a task. And as those tasks disappear, we end up then in breeding them selectively to encourage physical traits that we identify with that particular breed.
Right.
So you have like situations like with boxers where you no longer actually need boxers to perform the task they were bred for. Mm-hmm. And instead you just breed them to look even more and more like a cartoon character of themselves.
Right. They're no longer in the ring.
Yeah. And then they're no longer in the ring. I believe they were used to control cattle and bulls.
Okay.
Yeah. Like, I think it's like a slaughterhouse situation. So we have robots for that now. So instead, you're just like, hey, let's breed them, make them look funny, and stand on the side of a football field. Likewise, even with sheep herding dogs. Like my family has a herding dog, and they don't have sheep or anything. So the dog just loves to run around and bark at trees and attempt to herd things like tractors or branches in a tree or hawks flying overhead.
Right.
And you just think, wow, we've really screwed this one up. We've taken this animal's natural hunting instinct, turned it into something that benefits us, and then say, oh, all right, we're eliminating that job, but you guys stick around and just go crazy.
Yeah. And that's actually where the problem comes in, right? Because, I mean, you know, it sounds like in this scenario, at least your dog can go out and hang out in the yard. But some of those types of dogs are, you know, confined to apartments, and they just go around in circles. And basically then, you know, next thing you know, they're on Zoloft. So,
yeah.
But what allows us to do this, to breed these traits, is that they have such a great plasticity of genes. And it takes just 25 years to create some sort of breed that you want, which, if you look at evolutionary terms, is like supercharged evolution, in a sense, right?
Yeah.
And there's actually a good example of this is a dog called the Dogo Argentino. And it has something like, you know, 12 different breeds that they tinkered with over 2.5 decades to create the perfect dog that could take down wild boars without killing the boars, but could also hang out with kids.
Oh, wow.
You know, and be all cuddly.
Wow, that was an interesting checklist when they were putting that one together. It's like, I needed to be able to take down a boar, but I wanted to hang out with my kid too.
Yeah, and in 25 years and taking everything from like a mastiff to, I think there was actually, it may be a bull terrier in there somewhere in the mix, and just tinkering around with it. And then finally they had something that, again, this was helping them at the time because they really did have this wild boar problem that was eating all the crops. And so they wanted to take them down without killing them. And this was a good solution. But it's also a little bit frightening too that we could do this to such a degree.
Right.
Hence the eugenics part, which, you know, that's a whole other.
Yeah,
Pandora's box.
There are
right
two
there.
Sides to the eugenics coin for sure.
Yeah, yeah. And then, of course, the other problem with this, or you know, problem in the sense when it's not used, perhaps with the best of ethical intentions, is when you have someone who's a disreputable breeder who is continuing to breed so aggressively that there are a lot of defects that the dog might be born with.
Right. Yeah. You end up with in some cases genetic and neurological problems.
Yeah.
Like for instance, there's the whole fainting goat thing. If you're anyone familiar with the fainting goat, these are goats that they just happen to through breeding they have this neurological condition where you'll frighten them and they'll fall over. And for a number of reasons, the breeders decided, hey, let's keep this. This is a good trait to have in a dog, even though it's not really, I mean, in a goat, even though it's not really a good trait. And there are some breeds of dogs that have similar conditions just because they've been this sort of narrow, branch on the tree as they've continually bred to encourage, various traits that are part of that breed.
Yeah, so I mean, there's a lot going on here that can actually tell us about ourselves too. Of course, we always, as humans, figure out how we can get some data off of you know, other scenarios. And
right.
So, if there are certain diseases in dogs, like the boxer genome has been decoded, so that's been really helpful in saying, okay, on this marker we find this disease. Let's now flip over to the human genome and see if we can find it there and see what it can tell us about this disease. So that's actually helpful.
Yes.
Yeah. So, okay, so we know this. We know about the eugenics part. We know why we hooked up with them. But my question is, you know, how well do dogs really know us? And how well do we actually know them? Is there data there? You know, are dogs as good as reading our emotions as we think they are?
Well, it's interesting that they can definitely communicate with us, not every species can do this.
Right.
For instance, you have the case of Chaser, the border collie from Spartanburg, South Carolina, that apparently knows 1,022, perhaps more now. Who knows? I think this article is from like a year ago. 1,022 nouns. And it can also identify verbs. Like the owner was able to teach it to understand commands like fetch ball, fetch frisbee, fetch doll.
Right.
And it was understanding both the verb and the noun. So that's pretty amazing.
And she knew categories too, right?
Yes.
Like, you know, she knew like the balls, the toys, and so on and so forth. So she could be directed even at a greater level. And from what I remember too in that article, the owner had worked with her for like 5 to 6 hours a day, repeating words sometimes 40 times, like a new word 40 times every day, which is insane. And if you think about this too, we, as humans, learn something like 10 new words a day until we reach, I believe, the 12th grade.
Yeah.
In which case we then have something like 60,000 words at our disposal. But here's this border collie getting 40 new words a day to our 10 words a day. So that is actually a particularly strange situation. This is, you know, most dogs know something around the order of 150 words.
Yeah, but then again, six hours a day with this old dude in his apartment.
Yeah,
you know, it's like if I was stuck with him and he was coaching me on vocabulary, I'm sure I would learn all these fabulous new words in a steady basis.
I know. I think we all should just go spend a week with him. But the other thing about dogs, and this is something that's been proven out, is that they really have learned to read our emotions. And this was found again in the Nova Dogs Dakota documentary. What they said is that when humans express emotions, they do so asymmetrically. And what that means is if I express anger or joy, if you go down the middle of my face and cut it in half and examine it, you'll see that it's not symmetrical in the way that I express those emotions. So one part of my face is going to be different than the other.
Okay.
It's not going to be, of course, like, too crazy looking. It's pretty nuanced.
like whatever the face is, when like if you smile on one side of your face and frown on the other.
Yeah.
But you're talking like even a normal, what we might on the surface think of as a normal smile is still not a completely symmetrical thing.
Yeah. What looks cohesive really isn't. And that's such a nuanced thing. But what they did is they said, okay, for humans, when we're looking at emotions and reading emotions, we start on the left-hand side and then we go left to right. So we have a left-hand bias.
Okay.
So what they did is they wanted to see if dogs did the same thing. So lo and behold, they put them in front of a screen and they watched the dog's reactions. They filmed the dog and they saw that the dogs did the same thing. They went from left to right. Although when dogs look at each other, they do not read from left to right. And as far as they know, dogs are the only species that can read human emotions in that way, in the way that we do.
So they know that, like, this is how you read a human's face. You have to look left or right.
Yeah. Huh. Yeah. In order to pick up on that nuance of, okay, well, that's the emotion that I think that is being expressed by my owner right now, which is really pretty interesting. So again, there's this idea that dogs have evolved to read a human's face and that makes dogs understand us in a way that other species don't. And again, hence the bond that we feel with them, that they can actually feel our emotions. And they also respond to gestural cues like pointing.
Yes. Though it's interesting that there was a study, from the Department of Comparative and Developmental Psychology at the Max Planck Institute for Evolutionary Anthropology in Germany.
Go Max Planck.
Yeah. They've come up before. Where they looked at irrational and rational acts.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the example. You have human infants and a mother. Like, if the mother turning on the coffee maker.
Uh-huh.
Well, I guess not the debate. Well, we're going to roll with this analogy. All right. So the baby sees the mom using her hand to turn on the coffee maker.
Okay.
All right. And they'll on some level connect and say, that's a good use of that hand.
That's a rational use.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, and then they see the mother, with an armload of clothing. She doesn't have a free hand, but she needs to turn on the coffee maker, so she uses her forehead to do it.
Yeah.
Or her nose, I don't know. And then the child will be like, all right, well, given this situation, that makes total sense. But if the mother were to walk in with nothing in her hands, two free hands, and then reached over and turned on the coffee maker with her forehead or nose, the child would not see this as a rational act.
No, that's coconuts.
Yeah. But the dog, there's no coconuts with the dog. The dog would just accept either act. There's no difference between a rational and a rational act.
Okay. So that's a case in which we might be projecting ourselves onto whether or not a dog can make those sort of judgments.
Right. I mean, and another thing is the whole, like, oh, my dog did something bad. And now he's sorry, or she's sorry. Look at her. She's so ashamed of herself. But that's just a submissive behavior. They're not really ashamed of anything.
Right.
There was an interesting study into that that was actually profiled on the Radio Lab episode Animal Minds, which is a good listen for more of a broader animal emotional thing. But you had these people that, you know, were claiming, oh, my dog thinks it did something bad. It knows it did something bad, and that's why it's ashamed. But they found that, that dogs in a control group would behave the same way, even if there had been no mischief in the living room, et cetera.
Yeah, and that's why animal behavior is so tricky, right? Because you've got the whole fact that your dog is so tuned into you that you can't help but think that the dog is with you in lockstep in the way that you're thinking and acting. And in fact, they call it the Clever Hans effect. And Clever Hans was actually a horse in the 1900s that could use his hoof to count and answer mathematical questions. And he was just like the star of the animal world, right? Mm-hmm. Everybody was astounded by his knowledge. But a psychologist picked up on the fact that the horse answered correctly only when the questioner knew the answer. So what was happening is that the horse would count up until the point in which they observed the questioner began to relax when Clever Hans had reached the correct number. And again, it's that nuance of being able to read body language and say, oh, okay, the human is fine now. This must be the right answer and I'll quit, you know, stomping my hoof. So they've talked about that with dogs as well, is that, you know, there's that fine line of, you know, how much is the dog just trying to read your emotions and your gestures as opposed to really cogitating.
Yeah, it's like there's this fiction we create where this dog is this friend or this child in our lives, but the animal is participating in this fiction as well. And I find that really fascinating. I mean, I don't think it downplays the what's amazing about the relationship.
Yeah.
But it's kind of like blind men and elephants, where one is touching one part of the elephant and the other's touching the other, and they both have certain ideas about what's going on, but neither one is the correct. Neither one is the actual image of the elephant.
Well, and we've talked about symbiosis before, right? Mm-hmm. And parasites. And this reminds me of that. This is sort of like the mutually beneficial parasitic relationship.
Right.
Right? I mean, your dog is pretty much like, well, you know, I'm sure that your dog gives you a lot of love or perceived love, but your dog is really kind of, you know, just hanging out on your couch, eating your food, watching your TV, not necessarily contributing to the household income, right?
Right. But maybe participating to your feeling of safety in your house or elevating your emotions. So there's a different benefit. Maybe it's barking at strangers. Or if you're really on the ball, maybe it actually does work around the house. Or then you have like seeing eye dogs, and helper animals.
Yeah.
Where there's a definite, case to be made for this symbiotic relationship is really, working on all cylinders.
Yeah. And see, I think the two are so entangled that it's really hard to look at this and say, you know, is there a definitive love or not?
Right.
And what complicates it is the way that we actually react to dogs as well. Dr. Adam Michalski at a research center in Hungary recorded 6 different scenarios in which a dog was barking. And this is important because dog barks, we often hear, and then we think, oh, the dog is feeling this way or that way. And so what he had observed a lot of humans saying, oh, well, my dog does this mewing sound, or actually it's like a cat, right? but this complaining kind of whiny sound, you know, she's hungry or so on and so forth. So he wanted to see if he could actually corroborate that. So he had these 6 different scenarios in which a dog was barking. And a couple examples is, as you actually mentioned, is, barking at the door, barking at the gate when a stranger approached. And he recorded that bark. And then another example was when the owner put the dog on a leash and then left the dog. And the dog started barking as if to say, you know, don't leave or whatnot. And he took these 6 different recordings and played them for dog owners, not the dog owners that the dogs are attached to,
but just other
totally
dog
random
owners, yeah.
dog owners. And those dog owners could almost without fail each time say, oh, I can, you know, I think that that dog is going to be lonely, or that dog wants to play fetch, but someone is withholding the ball. I mean, they got it really very, you know, these specific details right, which amazed him that they could map the emotion to the bark, which begs the question, are we so now like fine-tuned with them that we're reading their cues just as much as they're reading ours?
Huh. It's kind of like it's kind of like we're both actors in a play, and we've both forgotten that it's a play. It's an imperfect metaphor, but
No, I'm going with it. Yeah, you're like Dustin Hoffman, and for weeks after one of your roles, you continue to act as though you're autistic.
Yeah, that's right. You argue that he never got over the Rain Man thing.
No, I know. I think it comes out in spurts sometimes. I mean, it was a fine performance. Don't get me wrong, but. Anyway, to your analogy. So, I don't know. It gets us to this point where we can't definitively say, does your dog actually love you? We know there's a lot of oxytocin flowing.
Yeah. The naturally generated drugs in our body kind of complicate things. But
yeah.
But that can be said of pretty much everything that we do.
So. Yeah. And on a personal level, I can say that my dog, Ted, I certainly loved. She was a wonderful dog. And I felt that way to her. And I think as a child, I even read to her. I loved her so much.
Yeah. Did she pick up on anything? Were you able to?
No. She was no Clever Hans or, what was the other dog's name? Chaser? She was no Chaser.
Yeah. Chaser.
Yeah.
Now there's that cat that writes mystery novels with its, owner. I forget the author's name.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
That is probably the best case of anthropomorphization I've ever heard.
I wish I could remember her name. I have not read any of her work, but if I remember correctly, she used to write like kind of saucy literature.
Of course.
And then suddenly she started writing mystery novels with her cat, and has continued ever since. It's been one of those great literary partnerships. So
yeah. There you go.
Well, hey, I think I have a little listener mail here.
Ooh, let's see.
Let's see what we have. Ah, yes, both of these are related to our Germ-Free Dirty Hippies episode, which recently went live. First, we heard from Luke, and Luke writes, "Hey, Julie and Robert, I just listened to the Germ-Free Dirty Hippies episode. You guys touched on the idea of not using shampoo. I wanted to let you know that I haven't used shampoo since November 17th, 2007, and my hair has never been healthier. I used to have lots of dandruff and a very sensitive scalp. Now my hair looks healthy, doesn't itch, isn't oily, and doesn't smell. It got really oily for the first 3 weeks or so of not using shampoo, but then it seemed to balance out. I have so much shorter hair, and it's about 2 inches long on top, so I'm sure this makes it easier than if I had really long hair. I know some people who don't use shampoo rinse it out every so often with a mix of apple cider vinegar and water. I'm not sure what this does. Maybe it helps get rid of oil. Anyway, I've never thanked you two for the awesome show, so I thought I'd take this opportunity to write in and say thanks for making me smarter." Well, you're welcome. That's great.
Yeah, and actually we got a lot of anecdotal evidence about this, I would say, if you can call it evidence. And it was actually really heartening. I was like, wow, people are really – it's not just me who's interested in this shampoo question.
Yeah, I've cut down. I'm going like 2 days at a time without actually shampooing my hair.
Your coat looks very shiny. Oh, I mean, in a good way. It looks nice.
Well, I also had bacon this morning. You know,
well, that'll do. That's a nice sheen.
Bacon bits. But, and we also have another email. This one is from Thomas, and Thomas writes in about this. And this is a rather long email, so I'm just going to read part of it. He says, "Anyway, let's just say that in the past 12 months, I've probably used shampoo maybe 6 or 7 times. Until 2 weeks ago, I hadn't used shampoo in probably 6 months. Generally speaking, I only use shampoo if I go to the beach or swim in a heavily chlorinated pool, though I do use conditioner about once a month. Let me just say, my hair is gorgeous. That's probably the most narcissistic sentence a 23-year-old male can utter, but it is. Random women, that's right, plural, have stopped me just to say, 'Hey, I've seen you around the office, and I just wanted to say, I don't know what you do, but you have gorgeous hair.' Well, I think we both can relate to that."
Absolutely. Yeah. Get it in the break room all the time.
Yeah, Jerry had to lock the door to keep the women out. Otherwise, they'd be in here complimenting us on our hair right now.
That's right.
Yeah. Thomas continues, "You can't imagine the speed with which a human face can transition to abject horror when I quote how long it's been since I've used shampoo. It's quite a sight. The worst part of terminating your relationship with shampoo is the first 2 months or so. During that 2 month period, your scalp seems to freak out and overproduce oils. Lots of warm showers and scalp massaging, like Julie mentioned, help a great deal, but it's still kind of gross."
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
That's the secret to healthy hair.
Yeah. So, if you have any more anecdotes of your own experiences going with the no poo method of hair care, let us know. I mean, we can't.
That's short for shampoo, in case anybody's confused about that.
If you have any other no poo situations, let us know about that. We're always game for scatological content. And if you have anything to add about this dog episode, let us know. I'm sure I know that a number of you are dog owners, and if you're like me as a cat owner, then you probably spend a lot of time just trying to figure out this weird situation in which a furry quadruped lives in your home, sleeps on your bed, and we act like it's the most normal thing in the world. But
yeah.
It's not. It's pretty weird.
And you occasionally dress them up as a pirate. I mean, that's yeah. They want to hear about that.
Yes. So let us know. It's fascinating. And I'm curious to see what everybody's particular thoughts on it are. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter. We are Blow the Mind on both of those.
And you can drop us a line at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com. To learn more about the podcast, click on the podcast icon in the upper right corner of our homepage. The HowStuffWorks iPhone app has arrived. Download it today on iTunes.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.